We'll hear argument now in the case of Northeast Communications of Wisconsin against CenturyTel. Mr. Schott.
Thank you. May it please the Court, members of the Court, my name is Don Schott. I represent Northeast Communications. My client, in the late 1980s, joined with four other companies that did landline telephone business in an area of Wisconsin known as RSA number 10, to form a limited partnership to carry out the business of providing cellular telephone service. Two of those five companies were very small companies that had a very close relationship to one another, a special relationship, and they were involved not only in passive ownership of the limited partnership interest, but also in actual operation ownership. In drafting the limited partnership agreement, the five parties dealt with two related but somewhat different issues. The first issue is what to do in the instance if one of the five companies decided to sell the limited partnership interest in the RSA 10 limited partnership. The second issue was what would happen if one of the companies either was sold, the company was sold, or else perhaps had assigned its limited partnership interest to a subsidiary with other limited partnership interests and then sold that subsidiary. In other words, a situation where there would be a change of control with respect to the ownership of the limited partnership interest.
The problem is that the clause in question here in the agreement, 11.5, is broader than that. What you've just been describing, your last remarks were addressed at what that clause means, as I understand your argument.
Yes.
But the language of the clause goes beyond just changes of ownership and control.
It does, in the sense that if 11.1 wasn't there, simply a sale of the limited partnership interest could be covered by 11.3 or 11.5. But I think when you look at the whole agreement together, that what the parties were intending to do is say, we're going to deal with the first issue in 11.1, a sale of just the interest. Then we're going to deal with the second issue or set of issues, sale of a change of control or a transaction that results in a change in control, and we're going to do that in one of two ways, depending on who it is that is selling. If it's Wayside or Northeast, we're going to deal with that in a section 11.3, and if it's Casco, Lakefield, or Universal, the other three, we're going to deal with that in section 11.5. And that's how I believe the three sections relate to one another. 11.1 deals with the specific example or specific situation of a sale of the limited partnership interest. The other two provisions deal with the change of control situation itself. And under Section 11.3, the parties clearly said that if Wayside or Northeast sell or engage in a transaction that results in a change in control to anybody, there would be rights of first refusal. First, that would go to the non-selling entity between those two, and then to the other three if there's not an exercise under that first right of first refusal. With respect to Lakefield, Casco, and Universal, that's Section 11.5, and there's a great deal of dispute. That's what this case is about. How is that section to be interpreted? Our point of view is that that section was intended to do the same thing for those three companies as Section 11.3 does for Northeast and Wayside. In other words, give a first right of first refusal within that group of three. If they choose not to exercise it, then it gives a gives that first right of refusal back to either Northeast or Wayside.
What if both non-selling entities in 11.5 want to exercise that right of first refusal? The agreement doesn't say what's supposed to happen then.
It doesn't in that if you go back to the prior sentence, which is the sentence that attempts to address that, it talks about the non-selling entity. Which doesn't make any sense when you have a situation where there's three. And the explanation for that, I think, is very important to this case. As Altel points out several points in their brief, Section 11.5 was added to the agreement after Section 11.3 had been drafted. And, in fact, in their brief, they cite materials that they submitted to Judge Griesbach as part of the summary judgment process as part of that record. And when you trace back that cite, the factual basis for that is the testimony at the trial that occurred in the 1990s in the dispute between Wayside and Northeast of the attorney that actually drafted both sections, Mr. Vandecastle. And he testified that he drafted Section 11.3. Then after that was drafted, he was told to draft Section 11.5 because the other three partners had expressed a concern about quote, having the same type of provision in the agreement for themselves as was between Northeast and Wayside. And I think when you look at Section 11.5, the best way to understand it is to see that the drafter took 11.3 and then created a new provision, 11.5, to try to accomplish the same purpose, and he forgot to make a change in that prior sentence because the difference between 11.3 and 11.5 is 11.3 deals with two parties and 11.5 deals with three parties. And in the last sentence, he tried to accomplish that purpose rather than go through very cumbersome language to try to shorten things down. But he didn't think about the prior sentence and just making a plural there instead of keeping it a singular. But I think that's really the way to understand the relationship between these three provisions, is to understand that 11.1 was there first, and that's just dealing with the interest itself. 11.3 came into play because Northeast and Wayside had this special relationship. If you look at the ownership interest, between each of them owned 27% of the limited partnership. So together they owned control. And so they wanted to make sure that if there was a change affecting either one of them, that they would have the ability to have a right of first refusal. And then it was later that the other three said, well, if Northeast and Wayside want this provision amongst themselves, then we want a similar provision amongst ourselves. And there's no reason to assume, as Altel argues in this case, that the purpose of 11.5 was to be very, very different than 11.3. Altel's argument is that all the parties wanted to do in 11.5 is to apply to situations where there's a change of control as a result of transaction within the group of three, but not to apply if there's a transaction affecting a change of control where an outsider comes in. There are two problems with that argument.
You're interpreting the subject to purpose, then. Is that correct when you make that statement?
The subjective purpose both of this provision but also of rights of refusal generally. And I think in interpreting the contract, you can look at what is one of the purposes of writing a right of first refusal.
What does the subject of purpose mean? No, that's at the heart of this controversy, right?
It is. And I think that one of the purposes of the rights of first refusal, as the law has recognized, is to keep strangers out of a relationship, or at least give the parties the ability to do that. And here it's clear that what the parties did is created a wall. And they said, we're not going to let strangers into this relationship. If somebody wants to sell their limited partnership interest, we're going to have a wall that prevents that. If Northeast or Wayside wants to sell to anybody, we're going to have a wall that prevents that. Altel's argument, however, is that the parties intended to create a huge gap in that wall, and to say, well, if one of those three companies wants to sell to one of the others, we'll have a wall that prevents that. But if they want to sell to AT&T or, you know, the Dr. Evil cellular telephone company, that is okay. We're not going to prevent against that. That makes no business sense. Why would they want to structure the agreement that way? What makes business sense is to say that the intent of 11.5 is to accomplish the same thing for those three companies, Casco, Lakefield, and Universal, as was accomplished by Section 11.3 with respect to Northeast and Wayside, which is to say that if there is a change of control transaction, the first right of first refusal, the first tier of rights, goes within that group of three. But if neither of them choose to exercise it, then it goes to the remaining limited partners, Northeast and Wayside. And that, I believe, is the correct way to interpret those provisions.
How does 11.3 fit into that description?
It fits into the description two ways, I think, Your Honor. Number one, it fits into the description because it makes clear, and I don't think there's any dispute about the way 11.3 works. 11.3 is triggered if there is a change of control transaction involving a third party, and I don't think there's any dispute about that. So if that's the case, if the parties said, Northeast and Wayside, if you want to engage in a change in control transaction, for example, sell your whole company to an outsider, then the group has an opportunity to come in and get your limited partnership interest. if they decided to do that with respect to Wayside and Northeast, why wouldn't they do the same thing with respect to Casco, Lakefield, and Universal?
Well, this case, though, isn't so much about what sort of transaction triggers the right of first refusal. That's what the Wayside litigation was about.
Correct.
And the Court of Appeals of Wisconsin told us what that language means, interpreting the same contract, as I understand that litigation.
Correct.
It's about what the meaning of the residual language is.
It is, because the argument that was made here by Alltel is, I think, because they understood, in light of the prior decision, that they couldn't make the argument that change of control wasn't triggered here because we did the change of control, in their case, I think, 7 or 8 steps up the ladder. In the earlier case, it was 2 steps up the ladder. But if you go back to that earlier case, that case involved not only the trial between my client, but also there was a sale by Casco to PTI, to a third party, to an outsider.
Right.
If you accept Alltel's argument that they're making here, the right of first refusal wouldn't have been triggered in that case. That was never even argued in that case and never even presented in that case, and clearly the Court of Appeals held that the rights of first refusal did apply to the Casco PTI transaction, which it wouldn't apply if Alltel's argument is a correct interpretation of the agreement.
But there are a number of these limited partnership agreements among some or all of these same parties floating all over Wisconsin, as I understand it.
Yes.
And some of them have been litigated. We have the Wayside litigation that's implicated in this case. I was able to find one other case that was decided by an unpublished decision by the Wisconsin Court of Appeals. I don't know if there's any other interpretive history out there from other courts interpreting the same or similar language in these agreements. And I understand that language differs from contract to contract.
It does, and I think if you look at the agreement itself, you can see, you know, the parties themselves, the 5 companies, are only referred to in, I think, 4 sections of the agreement, Section 11.3, Section 11.5 that we've talked about, and then I think there are Sections 5-point-something in where they talk about the capital contributions. It has the read about it, and I'm not sure this is in the record, so I want to be careful about how I phrase this, but it has the read about it of somebody taking what you might call a form agreement, an agreement used in other situations, and that's where Section 11.1 comes from. It's a rather standard right of first refusal that applies to sale of the interest. But here, the parties wanted to do something more than that. They were particularly concerned not just about what happened if somebody sold the interest, but what happened if there was a change of control transaction. Because these were very small, locally owned, family-owned companies that had been small telephone companies in rural Wisconsin for 100 years. And they were very concerned about letting an outsider into the relationship. That was why they specifically came up with Sections 11.3 and 11.5, which is, I'm sorry, sort of a long-winded way of saying I don't think any of the other litigations really touch directly on this point, because 11.3 and 11.5 were really very specifically negotiated sections.
So there isn't any other judicial decision out there that we need to be alert to, apart from the one that's been referred to in the briefing, and then this, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly, Shabardin?
The Shabardin case? Not that I'm aware of, and certainly not a published decision that I'm at liberty to cite. I would like to reserve the remaining time for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, Mr. Schott. Mr. Arnston.
May it please the Court. Northeast here concedes that it doesn't have any right of first refusal rights as to this transaction under Sections 11.1 and 11.3, which are the 2 sections that expressly set out right of first refusal rights to Northeast. Instead, they're trying to shoehorn an implied right of first refusal under Section 11.5, even though that section expressly states that it only applies among Lakefield, Casco, and Universal, and is directly contrary to the position that Northeast took 13 years ago in the Wayside case. The plain language of Section 11.5 makes clear that Judge Griesbach correctly held that it conveys no rights on Northeast with regard to this transaction, and that the judgment below should be affirmed. Now, where you've got to start out, of course, with the plain language of the agreement, the title of Section 11.5. Its title says that it's right of limitation of transfer and right of first refusal, as among Casco, Universal, and Lakefield. Then it starts out, any provision of Section 11.1 to the contrary notwithstanding. So with regard to this hierarchy of arguments, hierarchy of provisions argument that that Northeast argues, saying, well, if it's a direct sale, you should look at 11.1, but if it's some other change of control, you should look to 11.5. First of all, that's contrary to the language of 11.5, which encompasses sales. Second, it's contrary to the structure of this agreement. I mean, what you've got is you've got your general right of first refusal in 11.1, this limited to actual transfer of the partnership interest. And that is the provision that I would agree it appears its goal is to restrict the ability of strangers to come into the agreement. Now, it's written specifically in terms of direct transfers of partnership agreements. If, as Northeast said, what they really wanted to do is preclude a broader change of control, you know, acquisitions of grandparents, great-grandparent companies, it would have been real easy to just put that change of control language right in Section 11.1. Because, you know, with rights of first refusals, there are trade-offs. The benefit is you keep strangers out. The cost is that you're affecting the marketability of your interest and perhaps devaluing the, you know, reducing the value of your interest, just like an option on your house might, a right of first refusal might restrict other buyers' interests. So I believe looking at the structure of these provisions, what you've got are two subgroups, Wayside and Northeast in 11.3, and then the other three partners in 11.5. And by the way, we do disagree with Northeast's position that everybody would agree that if we were looking at 11.3, it would apply here. It wouldn't. We submit that looking at 11.3, again, that is just providing a right of first refusal to either Northeast or Wayside. And again, that's exactly what Northeast said in the Wayside case. They said in their post-trial reply brief, it's Exhibit G of Item 43 of the record, the rights in Section 11.3 of the agreement apply solely between Wayside and Northeast. Whether this is judicial estoppel or not, one thing it is, this is a 1994 statement. It's a statement made a heck of a lot closer to the time of when these parties are earning into this agreement than now, and it's directly contrary to what Northeast is saying in this case. And then you get down to the operative language. As Judge Griesbach interpret this, I mean, the logical hierarchy, if somebody is looking to sell an interest, is you first look to 11.3 and 11.5, which respect the rights of the subgroups defined therein. And then if you get through that and there's still a right of first refusal issue, if the right of first refusal exercise hasn't taken it off the table, then you go back to 11.1 and you see, does anybody have any rights under that? And under Northeast's interpretation of 11.5, that would read 11.1 out of the agreement. 11.3 and 11.5 between them would, if you give all partners rights under 11.3 and 11.5, you eliminate 11.1 from the agreement. Then you shouldn't do that.
But your interpretation, which was adopted by the district court here, gives the residual language in 11.3 and 11.5 no independent function.
The residual language.
The residual language about any interest not so purchased by Casco, Universal, or Lakefield
shall be subject to purchase
by the remaining any of the remaining other partners. I mean, that reads that language out of the agreement, or just reads it to simply duplicate what's in 11.1, as I understand the district court's opinion.
I don't think it reads out of the agreement. I think what it's making clear is that with 11.5, with regard to sales from any of these three entities, it is supplementing 11.1. It's not completely preempting it. The 11.1 still retains validity. In other words, 11.1 isn't superseded or eliminated by 11.5. 11.5 just comes in first, and then if there's anything left after 11.5, if partners have interests from some other provision other than 11.5, they can exercise them, such as under 11.1. I think it's just making clear that this isn't encompassing the whole field of rights of first refusal should Casco, Lakefield, or Universal sell their interest.
But what I'm referring to as the residual language doesn't contain any limiting language such
it
as
doesn't.
You're suggesting.
It doesn't contain that limiting. It doesn't expressly refer back to 11.1. But I submit that what that is confirming is that this 11.5 doesn't completely cover all of the rights that would apply if any of these three parties sell their interests. That if another partner has rights coming from some other source, those rights would still be in existence once you finish the application of this. I don't think it reads it out of the agreement. I think it makes clear that if this is a transaction that would be subject to both 11.1 and 11.5.
I assume that what you mean concretely is that if the interest is sold, then 11.1 applies in any event.
After 11.5,
the
correct.
Situation in which 11.5 can apply but not 11.1 is a situation in which the owner of the interest is sold.
Correct. And I believe that...
When the owner of the interest is sold, how is the interest valued on a right of first refusal?
When the owner of the interest is sold, again, 11.3 and 11.5 are the only provisions that would
I understand
apply
that.
There.
How is the interest valued?
Well, it's that it's either by the price of the offering price.
But no. Look, the whole point, when the owner of the interest is sold, the interest doesn't have a price.
Correct. And so then what you need, you have your three appraisers. Each side picks an appraiser, and the third, and then those two pick another appraiser, and they come up with a number.
Almost random.
As within the category of appraisal science, of applying the procedures appraisers apply. With regard to, then again, talking about the absence of...
Did the state proceeding, the one that construed 11.3, lead to a valuation dispute?
I don't know. I'm sorry. Then if you look at the intention language, the last sentence then Your Honor, talking about again this residual subject language, one thing that's interesting is looking at the structure of this, you first have the you've got the I'm grant of the rights to Casco, Lakefield, or Universal, and then you have these three or four sentences talking about the pricing issue that Judge Easterbrook addressed, and then this residual language, the subject to provision, comes after that. And so it's not at all clear how, at least here, you follow your right of first refusal with saying, okay, this is how you implement the right. And then you've got this subject to language without saying how you implement it. And again, I would submit that what makes the most sense in the structure of this agreement is you go back to 11.1 then, and you go through that procedure there. And
is
then
there
the
any precedent on this subject to language,
not
any other cases that attempt to construe this type of...
Not that I've been able to find, Your Honor, and I didn't find any in any of the briefs here. Somebody was writing something as they went along, and sometimes you get a little less guidance that way. But the intention, the last sentence really... it is very clear. So it says, what's the intent here? Talking about subjective intent. And it says it shall apply only to sales by Casco, Universal, or Lakefield or their affiliates, to each other, their affiliates. So it's got not only the from, but it's got the to, which is different from 11.3. And then it says, so as to give each of these entities, again, Casco, Universal, or Lakefield, a first right and option to purchase additional interest in the partnership. So that notice of intent is what I would submit. Northeast is relying on the Bruns case, and I'd submit that, again, a right of first refusal can have various provisions. The keep strangers out intent is evident from Section 11.1. I think what's clear from this, both the structure of this agreement and from this express intent language, is that is that this is to just provide rights to these three parties, just like Section 11.2 just provides rights to Northeast and Wayside.
But that contradicts the immediately preceding sentence, which contains the subject to language that we've been debating.
Right. And what I would submit to you again, this language shall be subject to purchase, is not a rights-conferring phrase. I mean, when these...
What is its purpose, then? If it's merely to be read coextensive with 11.1, what is it doing in there? Because the 11.1 clause is in the agreement and confers a right of first refusal, and so if why was the language put in?
What I believe makes the most sense in looking at the structure of this agreement is that it's clear to say that this is not destroying any right. This provision does not eliminate any rights that other parties, other partners may have otherwise. If you look in 11.1, 11.3, and 11.5, where they're granting rights, they say so very explicitly. And really,
does 11.3 have any subject to language?
Yeah, it's got the same clause.
It's got the same.
The one reason 11.3 is different is that if you look at the intent clause, it talks about sales by, and it essentially tracks the language of 11.5 there, but it doesn't say anything about sales to. And so when this and everybody agrees 11.5 was drafted after 11.3, and apparently, looking from the language, took 11.3 as a template, and they added the sales to language to it. You know, so if you're looking, you're trying to compare terms, under, so it must have meaning. And if you've got the sales to meaning, then that takes this transaction out of the scope of 11.5. If you look at 11.1, 11.3, when they're granting the rights, they say so. 11.1 says each limited partner shall initially be entitled to purchase. 11.3 and 11.5 say the non-selling entity, and it is entity singular, shall have the exclusive right to purchase. And so when they give rights, they say so. And they not only say this is the right, they then follow with a fairly extended procedure. 11.1's got one involving the general partner and stuff, and one process. 11.3 and 11.5 have another, again, fairly detailed process, as opposed to just this standing out there subject to purchase. And I'd submit that looking in the structure of the agreement, that is not, again, that's not a rights-conferring clause. It's a rights-preserving clause, and that is the best interpretation of that sentence. Again, if you're interpreting 11.5 the way Northeast argues it should be interpreted, you are rendering Section 11.1 surplus, as Judge Griesbach held, and we should avoid doing that.
Isn't the subject to essentially surplusage? It doesn't really add anything, does it?
Well, again, other than clarification to make clear that it's preserving what rights might be there otherwise, and it's not subsuming those rights. I believe it does retain it some viability under that section. And the, you know, looking at the structure of this agreement, what you've got is 11.1 that's there to keep strangers out, and you've got 11.3 and 11.5 to preserve balance within the subgroup. And again, whether you're looking at it in terms of judicial estoppel or just more contemporaneous statements of the parties of what the agreement means, the position we're taking here is exactly the position that Northeast successfully took in the 1994 Wayside litigation. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Schott?
Very briefly, first of all, in answer to your question, Judge Easterbrook, and I should preface this by saying I'm not sure this is in the record, but after the last trial, we did have an appraisal process, and I frankly can't remember whether we went all the way through that process or there was an agreement before, but I remember appointing appraisers and going through that process. Second point that I wanted to make.
Is the result of the appraisal definitive? That is, in what sequence is the decision made? First, do the appraisers come up with a value first, following which a party decides whether to exercise the right of first refusal? Or is a decision made to exercise the right of first refusal, and then the party must pay whatever the appraisers come up with?
The decision to exercise is made first.
And paying whatever the appraisers come up with is obligatory?
Yes.
Okay.
The second point I wanted to make is that, as I think has been pointed out by many of the questions, it is very hard to make sense of what is the purpose of that second to the last sentence of Section 11.3 or Section 11.5 if but for our argument. And that's why I think that as a matter of law, our argument wins and the agreement should be interpreted our way. But at a minimum, you should decide that that is a reasonable interpretation of this agreement. And if that is a reasonable interpretation of the agreement, even if there are other reasonable interpretations of the agreement, then the summary judgment decision needs to be reversed and a trial needs to be held on what was the actual intent of the parties, because
I
the provision is ambiguous.
I don't understand that. A trial on what?
What did
you haven't offered any extrinsic evidence. If there's no parole evidence, there's nothing to hold a trial about.
Procedurally, Your Honor, we made a summary judgment motion that said, based on the plain language of the of the agreement, we win. Frankly, our summary judgment motion was really aimed at the structure of the transaction because we anticipate.
Summary judgment is the put up or shut up time. If you got evidence, you got to offer it. And so far as I can see from the briefs, neither side has any parole evidence. And that being so, there's nothing one could possibly hold a trial about.
If I may respond to that very briefly, I know my time is up. If you look at the page 22 of Althill's brief, there is a citation to the record of the proposed findings of fact that were submitted to Judge Griesbach. And in those proposed findings of fact include the testimony of Mr. Van de Castle, the drafter of this agreement, who testified at the trial and testified exactly how 11.5 came into play, and he said it was intended to do exactly the same thing for those three parties.
We probably should not pursue this, but parole evidence means objective things like who said what to whom or what documents were exchanged. Wisconsin follows an objective rule, just like everybody else. What people thought subjectively a document would do is irrelevant if they did not express it to their trading partners.
The testimony of Attorney Van de Castle was he was told by one of the parties to draft Section 11.5 because the other three partners wanted a provision similar to the one. So I think that is objective evidence. It's what one of the parties told the attorney to put into the agreement. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.